For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Ishmael and Isaac, this stretch, and thankfully I will not be reading every verse, we'll be skimming. So much to cover here. It's really two stories about the births of two different boys. That's really what these stories focus on. But beyond the biographical information, the historical summary of what happened in both of these cases, in these two stories, we're learning two very different ways to follow God. Okay, so we are going to learn about how these boys were born, but as we do that, we're going to definitely just be able to see crystal clear, I hope, two vastly different ways of following God. And so the first story is about Ishmael. That's what we're going to start out with. It begins saying, Sarai, Abraham's wife, had not been able to bear children for him. Now, to really appreciate the gravity of these words, you have to know a little bit about a promise that God made to Abraham and Sarah. You got Sarah, who's called Sarai in this passage. You got Abraham, who's called Abram in this part of Genesis. And God had come to them, and not just once, but many times God came to this couple and promised that they would have a son. And not just a son, but that this son would have descendants that go on to be this great nation of people. I realize that kind of looks like a great nation of men's and women's restrooms. I don't want you to be distracted by that. You get the basic idea, right? The couple has a kid. The kid has the 12 tribes of Israel who become the great nation of Israel. That was the promise. The problem was, they couldn't have kids. That's what this verse says. Sarah had not been able to bear children. No child means no nation. We talked last week about how doubt is that gap we feel between what God promises and what we experience. Well, as the years rolled on, Abraham and Sarah were feeling that gap get wider and wider. This is a huge tension in this part of Genesis. It's this question of what's going to happen. You know, Abraham is old. He's like 99 years old coming up here pretty soon. And his wife is still not pregnant. And so it goes on and it says that Sarai had an Egyptian servant named Hagar. And so she said to Abram, the Lord's prevented me from having children. Go and sleep with my servant. Perhaps I can have children through her. And Abraham agreed with Sarai's proposal. Now, Hagar was Sarah's servant girl. And I'm not sure if she saw her unloading the dishwasher and the thought hit her, hey, my husband and Hagar, they could get together and actually make the baby that's going to bring about this nation. Maybe that's the way to get it done. And so we bring Hagar into the picture, and they sleep together. That's what those arrows symbolize. And they, we'll see, eventually produce a child. So if you wanted to summarize what we've just read here, you know, you think about what was their solution to this very pressing problem of childlessness. Their solution was self-reliance. I mean, they took matters into their own hands. They were done waiting. You know, look what Sarai says. She's like, God is actually actively preventing this from happening. He's not a promise keeper. He's a promise preventer. He's not allowing this to occur. So if we're going to get this done, we're going to have to find another way to do it. Our way, something that we come up with. And what they came up with was Hagar and Abraham having this child. You know, this approach we're seeing, relying on self to find a way to get God to honor his promises, doing it our way, this comes really natural to us, especially in this culture. These are some slogans we throw around. God helps those who help themselves. Where is that in the Bible? That's actually the gospel according to Ben Franklin. It's not in the Bible anywhere. God doesn't operate that way. That's not a principle he operates by. Just do it. It's catchy, but it's not biblical. It's not God's phrase. Here's an older one. I did it my way. All these things, this is the way we are. We see something and we just find a way to take care of it. We lift ourselves up by our bootstraps and we just get the job done. That's what Abraham and Sarah did. And they did it in a specific way. In a way that I want to talk about off and on throughout this teaching. They did it by relying on what I would call a cultural script. Okay, this is a big part of the story. Now, you guys know what a script is. You go to Wendy's, for instance, to order some food. And they say, hello, welcome to Wendy's. May I take your order? I mean, every single time, it's a script. And you know what the next line in the script is. It's, I'll take a Baconator, obviously. 950 calories, just, ugh. So yeah, I mean, that's a script. A cultural script is a little more complicated. See if you can follow this. A cultural script is a standard way our culture deals with various challenges that we face. And this could be all kinds of things. You could think about like finding a spouse. I'm going to hop on to dating.com or whatever it is. I'm going to check off a bunch of compatibility boxes. I'm going to zero in on how far I'm willing to drive. I'm going to meet and date 4 or 5 people. Maybe I'll live with one of them. And maybe if it goes well, we'll get married. You know, we have our scripts and they're not like identical. And some people like this script or that, but we borrow a lot of ways to handle challenges from our culture. It could be how to plan for retirement, how to cope with illness, how to handle conflict. It could be lots of things. Scripts borrowed from our culture. That's exactly what we're seeing Abraham and Sarah do. Back during their life, if a wife could not have a child, what they would do is, it was typical for the husband to look for somebody in his household, a servant, have a child through that person. The child, when it was born, would become the property or be owned by the mother so that the inheritance that went with that son would go with the mother as long as she was alive. It was a way to preserve her social standing. It was a common cultural script. And the problem with this, and this is true of all the scripts that you'll run into that we borrow from our culture even today, there's really two things. One is these scripts often lead us to diverge in different ways from the life of faith. They lead us oftentimes to do things that are things God would be opposed to. And not only that, they cause problems. They can lead to a really big mess. And that's exactly what we see here. So Hagar and Abraham hook up. They have a son, it says here. And it is a huge mess. If you read in the next verses, it says Abram had sexual relationship with Hagar. And she became pregnant. But when Hagar knew she was pregnant, she began to treat her mistress Sarai with contempt. And then Sarai treated Hagar so harshly that she finally ran away. Okay, so what you've got here is you've got Sarah, who's jealous and vindictive, who's mistreating Hagar. You got Hagar, who's kind of like, I did something for Abraham you couldn't do. And she's proud and she's mean. And just imagine living in this situation, living with these two women while this whole family's being ripped in two by this cultural script. This is the way it is a lot of times. You see something here, and this is deliberate on the part of the author. He's trying to establish cause and effect. When we depart from trusting God to keep his promises, when we do things our way, in our strength, on our timetable, instead of trusting God to honor promises on his timetable, when we rely on ourselves instead of relying on God, that's what happens. It happens a lot. The wheels come off. We pay a very high price for just reverting back to cultural scripts when we're under stress and strain. That's a huge theme in the story. Now, The other theme that's real big, and this is big in both of these stories, is how gracious God is. You know, nobody in this story deserves anything from God. You look at the way Hagar has behaved. She's been vindictive and mean. She actually, you know, just was basically taunting Sarah, despised her. Not good. And yet, it says that God comes to Hagar and says, "You will give birth to a son. You are to name him Ishmael, for the Lord has heard your cry of distress." You know, Hagar is being mistreated. She runs away from Abraham's household, and God comes to her in the wilderness and tenderly tells her, "I'm going to give you a child." It's a real picture of love and compassion. If you read a little bit later, we learn that as for Ishmael, God says, "I'll bless him also, just as you've asked, and I'll make him extremely fruitful, and I'll multiply his descendants. He'll become the father of 12 princes, and I'll make him a great nation." You know, the story with Abraham, his descendants went on to become the 12 tribes of Israel. It says here that Ishmael would become the father of 12 princes. So all of this, despite the lack of anything intrinsically good about Hagar that would make her worthy of this, God shows great grace and compassion, not just for her, but for her son and for all of their descendants. That's how he's disposed toward them. He's gracious. All right, so there you go. There's the first story about the first boy's birth. Now let's switch over to Isaac. Isaac, this story picks up, and we're running into the same problem. It's worse. 13 years have passed as we get into the Isaac story. 13 years since Ishmael was born. And so now Abraham is almost 100. Sarah's almost 99 years old. So they're both super old. And despite just how crazy it is to think, not just old people, but geriatric, you know, just super aged people, how crazy it would be for them to have a kid, God comes back and says, "I'm serious. You will have a biological child with each other." It says, "God said to Abraham regarding Sarai, your wife, 'Her name will no longer be Sarai. From now on, her name will be Sarah. And I'll bless her and give you a son from her. Yes, I'll bless her richly, and she'll become the mother of many nations. Kings of nations will be among her descendants.'" And so this is God's way of underscoring, "I mean it. I will give you a son." One way he underscores it is by saying it's going to be from her, from Sarah, not from Hagar. Ishmael was a false start. It's not what God had in mind. He was thinking of an actual biological descendant, not just of Abraham, but from Sarah. The other way he underscores it is he gives both of these individuals new names. This is just earlier in Genesis 15, Abraham receives a new name. He was Abram, becomes Abraham, and it means father of a multitude. It's just the way God is saying, "I'm serious." Sarai becomes Sarah, which means princess, a royal title, a title for someone who's going to become the mother of many nations. And so he's just with like a black marker underlining the fact, "I will do this. I promise." And so you'd think, wow. Oh, I wanted to throw one more thing in here. I forgot about this. The other thing you read about in chapter 15, it's another way to kind of put an exclamation point on this promise, is God says, "I want you, Abraham, I want you to get circumcised. And I want you to circumcise every male in your household. And this is going to be a sign. It's going to be a way that people in your home can voluntarily associate with the community of people that are benefiting from this and the other promises that I've laid out to you." Okay, so really, really strong wind-up, strong pitch from God. "I am going to honor these promises." And you would think at this point, if you're Abraham and Sarah, and you've been kind of wavering in faith and stuff, you know, God makes a special trip. He makes all these points. You think, well, that'd be great. I think if I was Abraham, I'd be like, "Thanks, man. I was struggling. I'm so glad you stopped by. I really needed to hear from you on this. But that's not quite how they react. If you read the next verse here, their initial response to this is Abraham falls on his face laughing. He says in his heart, probably because he didn't want to say it out loud, "Will a child be born to a man 100 years old? Will Sarah, who's 90 years old, bear a child?" He's like, "Yeah, no way." Later, God shows up a second time to make the same point, to reiterate this promise, and this is Sarah's reaction. Sarah says, God tells her, "I'll return to you about this time next year, and your wife Sarah will have a son." Sarah was listening to this conversation from the tent, and so she laughed silently to herself. And she said, "How could a worn-out woman like me enjoy such a pleasure, especially when my master, my husband, is so old?" And unlike chapter 15, where Abraham's asking questions and pleading with God for assurance, Sarah's question, that's a question with an assumed answer. How does an old woman like me have a child? Answer, she doesn't. She's too old. She's past menopause. It's biologically impossible. It's absolutely, laughably absurd. That's how they respond to God reiterating his promise. So pretty rough. You know, this is not the not quite the response that God was looking for. Well, at this point, I think if I was God, I'd be tempted to take my promises, pack them up, and go find somebody else to give them to. I mean, this is pretty disrespectful just to be treated this way. But instead of doing that, he shoots back at Sarah with a question of his own. He says, "Is anything too hard for the Lord? I'm going to return about this time next year, and Sarah will have a son." So God's got this question, and this is such a good question. Is anything too difficult for God? And I think we know the answer. The answer is no, but that's not what the answer feels like. A lot of us, you think about just the situation folks in this room are in. We're facing crises. We're facing challenges at work, conflict at home, I don't know, concerned about our kids. We're facing things that don't look like they're going to get any better anytime soon. And like he does with Abraham and Sarah, he comes to us in these moments of tension where we're challenged by what we're facing in life. And he says, "Is anything too difficult for me?" That's, you know, for a lot of us, we're wavering on, you know, what is the trajectory I'm going to follow in the next few years? This is God's question for you. What is too difficult for the Lord? Is anything too hard for the Lord? You know, this is just one of these gut checks, and that's exactly why God is delivering it. He's really pointedly telling Abraham and Sarah they've got a choice to make. They can continue believing against you know, all the biological evidence. They can keep believing God will honor his promises, that a miracle is coming. Or they can lapse back into the old script, into these cultural scripts, into this self-reliant script, ways of handling the situation with their own wits and strength and power. They really have to choose which one it's going to be, as we often have to choose. And you know, we don't know when, and we don't know how long it took them to get to this place. But they did choose, and they chose to believe this promise. That's what we read about. If you read in Hebrews, this is pretty remarkable. It says it was by faith that even Sarah was able to have a child. Though she was barren and was too old, she believed that God would keep his promise. So despite the fact that it was laughable and preposterous and seemingly impossible, Abraham and Sarah chose to affirm that God could still do it, still honor his promises. They had faith. Now, what did that faith look like? It looked like two old people trying to have a baby. Yeah. This, I don't know if it was daily. or weekly or monthly. I don't know what the schedule was. But they kept going. That's exactly what happened. And more than the fact that they kept trying to have a kid, more than that, what they did diverged, radically diverged from the cultural script. I mean, and not just here, not just you got a bunch of geriatric people doing totally the opposite of what most families would do. But God, and I think maybe with a sense of humor, I don't know, to up the absurdity level, he was like, hey, and let's have everybody, including you who are trying to have a kid, let's get circumcised. Let's get that done too. Like, if you're trying to have a baby, that's not exactly a good move to make. So you just realize anyone living in this household must have been, holy crap, this is insane. Who are these people? What's going on under this roof? This is nuts. This is so different, so strikingly different from what we would see in the culture. And you know what? It was. As it often is when we pursue the life of faith, when we actually trust God to keep his promises. It is true, the life of faith often looks unusual. This is something you see throughout the Bible. You see people blowing horns and doing laps around a city to make the walls fall. That's a departure from the script. Painting blood above a doorpost instead of like building a bomb shelter to avoid coming judgment. You think about people looking at a bronze serpent on a pole to be healed of a snake bite, or a troop of singers going out to meet an invading army. I could give you half a dozen more examples of just things that look unusual, that look strange. And maybe you don't know what all those specific references I'm talking about in the Bible are, but this is something you should know. This is something that the Bible emphasizes, and it's that people living the life of faith will diverge from cultural scripts in striking ways. Living the life of faith looks different. It doesn't look like what everyone else is doing. It isn't just copying the scripts other people are following. It's strikingly different to people in our culture observing the way we live, if we're living the life of faith. Well, here's what happens. So, God comes through. They have Isaac. They faithfully shuffle off to their tent, and voila, Isaac is born. And man, it's really cool to hear them celebrating. It says in 21:5, Abraham was 100 years old when Isaac was born. Sarah declared, God has brought me laughter. That's what Isaac's name means. Isaac's name means laughter. Every time somebody's like, hey, Isaac, it's a reminder that what they thought was absurd, actually God made possible. That's the whole point of naming him this. And it goes on and it says, all who hear about this, Sarah says, they're not going to laugh at me for being an idiot doing this stupid countercultural thing. They'll laugh with me. You know, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse a baby, and yet I've given Abraham a son in his old age? She got to hold this miracle, this Isaac, in her arms. Pretty amazing. So God comes through. And, you know, again, just like we see with Ishmael, and this is not a subtle footnote at the end of the story. It's a powerful emphasis. We see grace. You know, we see that God, despite Sarah's cynicism, despite, you know, her laughing out loud at how ridiculous it was, the way she mistreated Hagar and kicked her out of the house, despite all of that, God was willing to come through and honor this promise. That's grace. That's God's, like, I'm committed to keeping this promise, and it has nothing to do with a quality resident in you. I and I alone keep my promises. It's grace. That's what that is. So you think about these two stories, and I hope you're persuaded. They really do illustrate two different ways of following God. It's crystal clear, I think, as you go through it. That's what Paul points out as he reflects, in, you know, writing in the New Testament, as he looks back to these the birth of these two boys, this is what he says in Galatians 4. The scriptures say that Abraham had two sons, Isaac and Ishmael, one from Hagar and one from Sarah. The son of Hagar, listen to his language. The son of Hagar was born in a human attempt to bring about the fulfillment of God's promise, but the son of Sarah was born as God's own fulfillment of his promise. There it is. I mean, it's a clear distinction between a life of self-reliance, where we just do it, where we help ourselves so that God will help us, right? Where we just take care of business, versus a life that prioritizes trust in God to keep his promises. Really different. Now, there's so many places in your life where you could see this difference play out. It's so striking in a lot of different areas. But the one that Paul focuses on in Galatians is the area of spiritual growth. And I want to talk about this just from his perspective, just for a little bit. Two ways of trying to grow spiritually: self-reliance or relying on God's promises. In the first approach, the self-reliant approach, we view growing spiritually like dieting. It's basically, okay, I want to grow with God. I'm going to stop, like here, I'm going to stop eating everything I love to eat. I'm going to start eating everything I hate to eat. And I do hate kale with every cell in my body. They used to actually garnish salad bars with this. Now we're supposed to eat it. I mean, it used to just be decorative. Anyhow, under this model, you've got giving up the 10 things you like to do, starting to do 10 things you hate to do. What is it? It's a moralistic self-improvement program. It's me through self-effort and self-discipline gradually becoming more moral, more obedient, more compliant to what God wants. Many, 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 many people see Christianity this way. And it's not God's script. It's the world's script. This whole approach to growing, this isn't in the Bible. This is something borrowed from the world. This is a cultural script. It goes like this: select Christ-like attributes you want to work on, and then set specific and measurable goals to develop each attribute. I mean, it reads like a performance plan. And I don't know, have you tried growing like this? I'm just curious how that worked out for you. I'm guessing maybe not too well. Martin Luther is a real famous monk, real famous, started this thing called the Protestant Reformation. He tried to do this. He took this approach to spiritual growth, and this is how he describes it. He says, when I was a monk, I tried ever so hard to live up to the strict rules of my order. I used to make a list of my sins, and I was always on the way to confession, and whatever penances were enjoined upon me, I performed religiously. And in spite of it all, my conscience was always in a fever of doubt. The more I sought to help my poor, stricken conscience, the worse it got. The more I paid attention to the regulations, the more I transgressed them. And that is what the world's script will get you. That's exactly what it'll get you. I tried this. You know, I became a Christian as a 9-year-old little kid, super sincere, into reading my Bible. I prayed every night. I fought with myself, tried not to sin. And after about 2 years of moral self-improvement project by Mike or what, I just couldn't do it. And I quit. And I quit hard. I decided I am done with Christianity. It wasn't until 6 years later when I stumbled into a high school Bible study at this church and I heard for the first time in my life what God's script was for spiritual growth that I realized I think I might be able to do this. This is a disastrous lie, this way of viewing spiritual growth, as many cultural scripts are. Here's Paul's alternative. Thank God we don't have to follow this. How do Christians grow? He says, we, through the Spirit, by faith, are waiting for the hope of righteousness. Okay, so first, there is a hope of righteousness. God does want you to change and grow. He really does want to see you transformed morally. Absolutely, that matters to God. It really does. But there's a promise that comes with that. It's not something you go do. This is a promise God makes to you. Look what he says. May the God of peace himself sanctify you entirely. That's just a synonym for growing spiritually. He says, may God himself do it. And just in case you missed it, he says, faithful is God who calls you. He will bring it to pass. It is God's promise that we bank on to grow. That's the only way you can know that you're going to grow and make progress is because God has promised you it will happen. And so, yeah, there's the hope, but there's the promise that comes with it. Now, there's this waiting part. Ah, see, this is the hard part about the life of faith. We can't snap our fingers and have it like, you know, Amazon next day delivery or, you know, it's not that way. Everything of value that comes out of the life of faith is going to require some degree of waiting. And he's right. This is a key. We'll talk about this toward the end. Waiting is crucial. This is a crucial part of this lifestyle. And he says, how is it that we grow? Is it by just doubling up our fist and making it happen? No. It's through the Spirit by faith. It's through the activity of a promise-keeping God who says, I will work in you to change you. Now, you think about this faith. We know what it looked like with Abraham and Sarah, right? I looked hard for that picture. That's the best I could do. Yeah, they shuffled off to their tent. Yeah, they did whatever they needed to do in that tent. Now, listen, though, this is the big deal with this. It wasn't just the act of showing up every Friday night in the tent. They did this in faith. That was so crucial. Yes, they had sex again and again. But they did this knowing full well nothing was going to happen unless God showed up and gave them a son, right? So they did this in faith. Now, let's think about us. Is the life of faith just, okay, God, just mature me. I'll just lay here. No. We read the Bible. We pray. We're in community. We serve each other. The thing is, if that's just what you do, if this is just the disciplines that you follow, not good enough. That's not the way to relate to these things. These things aren't just ways we're like piling up brownie points with God. Trying to, you know, boost our stock in his eyes. No. We do these in faith. You engage, you come here, and you open your notebook, and you sit through a teaching in faith that God uses his word to grow and change you. You pray in faith that there's a God out there who actually listens and is mobilized by what we pray. We come into community because we believe these promises that we grow as each part does its work. All these things, we believe what Jesus says when he says it's more enriching to serve than to be served. Okay, so all of these things we embrace and we engage in faith. And I'll tell you, if you forget that, you've just reduced Christianity into just the self-improvement program. And that's not what it is. You know, picture a boat with big billowing sails. You know, I can hoist the sails. I've never sailed, so I don't know what I'm talking about, but just, I could raise the sails. I could get behind the wheel of the boat. I could, like, put tackle out or whatever they do. I could do the stuff, but if I don't let if the wind's not there, that boat's dead in the water. That's the way it is. We can do these things, but God is the one who causes growth as we, in faith, engage in these areas. Forget that, and it's a mess. Imagine, like, think about this promise and promises like it. I'm confident of this very thing. That he who began a good work in you will perfect it until the day of Christ. If you forget promises like this, are you going to be able to even look at Christian growth the right way? No. Christian growth is a miracle that God makes possible as we step toward him in faith. Yeah, so that's why he says, think about it. Just you could easily memorize this. We through the Spirit by faith are waiting for the hope of righteousness. There's a lot of wisdom in that, just that one verse. Now, let's think. I realize, okay, spiritual growth, it is kind of nebulous. It's a little nebulous. I agree. It's nebulous. What about a more concrete example? What would it look like to trust God to honor his promises in faith in a challenge that we face all the time? And the one I'm thinking of is resolving conflict. Okay, this is we're all in conflict. I'm well acquainted with this area. I'm very well acquainted with the world's script for handling conflict. Just ask my wife over the years, people that are friends of mine. I find myself in conflict quite a bit. And the world script isn't hard to figure out. It's defend yourself. Try to find anything, any way of getting out from under the possibility that it might be your fault. It's also deflecting to others. You know, if there's a way to turn the tables and get all the blame kind of showering on the person we're talking to, that's ideal. Defeating our opponent. You know, we defend our honor and try to destroy theirs. You know, just I want to leave a vanquished foe and teach them to never take me on again. That's my goal. And the bottom line, of course, is how I look. I mean, that is the script. I mean, just look at politics. Look at the business world. Look at marriages. Look at friendships. Look at the office environment. That is the script that people follow. And we don't have to try to do this. That's the thing with this. It just kind of comes natural to us. This is the wisdom of the world. This is the undertow that we're pulled toward all the time. What would it look like to actually trust God's promises here? Well, it would look like, all right, okay, God, you say you'll never leave me or forsake me, ever. You say that if you're for me, who can be against me? Like, nobody. If I've got you backing me, I'm good. And so knowing that, instead of defending yourself, you just entrust yourself to God. And when you do that, then things like this don't seem so crazy. You know, this is where Paul, he describes his perspective. He says, I don't even examine myself, yet I'm not by this acquitted, but the one who examines me is the Lord. You realize I'm not just limited to me and my resources and my honor. I've got God and his resources and his reputation to think about. And so it makes sense not just to entrust yourself to God, but if, God forbid, you did make a mistake or do something wrong or you were insensitive or whatever, you can own it. And it doesn't feel so costly that your world's crumbling because you're anchored to a promise-keeping God who's got your back. And of course, instead of defeating your opponent, there's a whole different world is opened up. You realize, I'm good. I'm covered. I'm loved. I can instead actually be the person in the room that initiates resolution. That can take the striking step of actually unprovoked, not because it's deserved, moving towards somebody to initiate resolution. You're able to do that when you have all of God's promises backing you. And of course, the bottom line, if you decide, I want to start to learn God's promises, actively think about them, and lean into them, your bottom line is never going to be the same again. And this bottom line, is it's not how do I look, it's how does God look? You have this moment where you realize, holy crap, God's going to empower me to do something so different, I might actually, by trusting him, I might be able to call attention to how good he is. Whoa. Now that is different. It is very different than our culture script. And it ought to be, if we're living the life of faith, it ought to be strikingly different as we handle these different challenges. So what do we do here? If we want to, you know, pull away from the tractor beam, the undertow, just our natural inclination to fall into these self-reliant scripts, what do we do? This is, you can go a lot of different directions with this, but I think one of the best ones is just to learn some new ones. This is how to what I'm about to cover has helped me so much to just try to get my brain around what does this life of faith and trusting God to keep his promises look like. You know, that's one of the great reasons why we need to get into the Bible. Read the book of Daniel. What you're seeing is a man who's in a crucible, facing all kinds of challenges, pursuing the life of faith. You don't have to wonder about what it looks like. You can read these examples of people who have done it. Same thing with, that's one of the greatest things about the Gospels. That's what Jesus is modeling, this life of faith and dependence on the Father. You know, another thing that's been a huge help for me, I'm a big fan of these, is reading Christian biographies. Reading about the life of Watchman Nee. Reading the life about, you know, Charles Wesley or George Whitefield or some of these great people, checkered, messed up, broken people, but people God used powerfully because they lived a life of faith. You can read not just about a day or two, but really you can see over the broad sweep of their life how things play out. When you trust God to honor his promises, it's powerful. You know, and for me, I would say this is the biggest one. This really had a huge impact on me. It was observing people I knew, people in our church right around here, who were actually living by faith. Now, this is kind of a, I don't know, I kind of went back and forth on this. It's kind of a silly story, but this was in my early Christian walk. This is one of the most impactful things I experienced. Years ago, in the early 80s, I was coming out, I was just starting into college, and I got wind that some of the older, like some of the leaders, some maybe an elder or two, a lot of them were living down or close to campus, somewhere in that area, and it was wintertime, and I heard that they were playing bumper tag with their cars. They were driving around on slippery roads, and if they saw each other, they'd speed up and try to like ram each other in the back quarter panel. And I was shocked. My script was do really well in school, get a really good job, get paid really well, get a lot of stuff, and be happy. And so here's these people. The people that are living a completely different way, driving around like smacking each other's gas caps off and stuff like this. And of course, is it good stewardship? No, it's bad. I'm not endorsing this. But I just remember thinking, there's a group of people here that are so excited about living for God and seeing their lives impact people. They've kind of been released from the tractor beam of materialism. And they've been able to see through it and realize a scratch on a car, who cares? What's a car ever going to get me? I want to be involved by God to see my life and other people's lives change. Cars pale in comparison. And for me, it was just like, it was pure oxygen. It was like, that's different. That's strikingly different. That's a totally different value system. It's a value system that says, unlike what everyone else says, I'm putting my eggs in God's basket. I'm going to make serving him a priority. And I'm going to pursue that lifestyle. And I was deeply, I kid you not, that story profoundly influenced me. To realize there's a better way. Because I realize this is a better way to live. That's why he says here, remember those who led you, who spoke the word of God to you, and considering the result of their conduct, imitate their faith. You have living models around you. And this is part of what we need to do. The other thing we need to keep in mind is that you're a script. This is a legacy issue. One of the biggest things you're going to leave behind is the script that you followed and the impact it had on your kids, your grandkids, your peers, your coworkers. Are people, when they look at you, are they seeing something strikingly different, winsome, and better? That's part of what people ought to see if we're living the life of faith. Us pursuing these scripts that are very different than what we see in the world. And then I think lastly, just remembering that God is a God of grace. This is, like I said, a huge theme in these stories. Here's probably the most diabolical and widespread script out there. And it goes something like this: if you want to get in God's good favor, you have to, through earnest devotion, merit it. That is such a widespread view of God, that I just have to earn his approval by good behavior. But look at this. Look how different this is. God says, this is back what he said to Abraham about Sarah: I will bless her. I will give. I will bless. I will give an answer to my promise. It has nothing to do with any merit on Sarah's part, Hagar's part. It's God and God alone who does this. That's what grace is. Nothing that we can make possible. It's what he's determined to give you. And so when you think about people, you know, trying to tease out whose job is it, his job is to keep the promises. His job is to make you right with him. Your job is to just have faith. So many pictures you see in the religious world of people trying to earn God's acceptance. This is a famous staircase in Rome where pilgrims go all the way up this stairwell on their knees to try to boost their merit before God. That's so wrong. That is the wrong script. The script that we've been given, it's all over the Bible. It's like this: it's by grace you've been saved. It's through faith, not from yourselves. You see the same theme? It's the gift of God, not by works, so that no one can boast. So that's really just like with Abraham and Sarah. That's the decision you have, is will I, not because I merit it, but because God's a promise keeper who's gracious, will I in faith call out to him to give me this salvation that he offers? That's the whole story of this part of Genesis. So, all right. Now, I thought it would be interesting, these questions that I just put up here, these really get at the heart of this part of Genesis. It's really getting at our heart attitudes about God. And I would encourage you over the next week, take a walk with the Lord and really work through these and how you feel toward God in these areas. Those questions really get at the heart of the issue. Yeah, I thank you that you laid to rest the question of your goodness when you sent your son to die for us, Lord. That answers that question right there. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.